All right, well, thank you. So I'm here to tell a story about a preservation space that we've built at the Boston Public Library. It's kind of a crazy thing we've done. We have, if you know anything about the BPL, we have 24 million items. And back in 2004, I was put in charge, pretty much by myself, to get it all digitized. Everything we have, somehow, someday, somewhere. But over the years, we started thinking about this crazy idea. You know, we got 24 million things. Let's digitize everybody else's stuff. So I'm here to tell the story about why we're doing that, how we're doing that. Another thing I want to emphasize, you know, the theme of this panel is preservation spaces. The flip side of that is access. So the system that we've built, digitalcommonwealth.org, among other library that we were put in charge to build early on, it was kind of, this is what it felt like. We're building it from the inside. And I love these cranes up here, and that's really how it felt. Currently, we are we've gone from that model, digitizing very locally, to becoming a service hub of the Digital Public Library of America. We have 350 different partners that we do digital projects for. We're currently indexing over a half a million items in Digital Commonwealth, all of which are then subsequently, the metadata is harvested by the Digital Public Library of America. So this really represents a pretty quick scaling of our resources. So how did this happen? It wasn't a big grand plan. Like all great creationists, art involves what? And it started pretty simply at the confluence of two very serendipitous events. One was a pretty good one, one was a pretty bad one. So on the upper left, that's the beginning of our digital library right there. And what happened in 1998 was a water main broke in Copley Square, flooded our basement. You can see some of the life's work of some of our librarians floating out the door there. So this is, if you go into the McKim building, this is what you'll find. So we wound up getting about $15 million in restitution. So anyway, we got a grant from IMLS to digitize and display all of the books in the John Adams Library. So we put those funds together, and I actually was working at a different spot at the time. I was down at the Massachusetts Historical Society, and I got a phone call from a friend who was working at the BPL and said, you know, can you help me spend this money? So that was the beginning of the digital library program at the Boston Public Library. There was no big meeting talking about metadata and preservation and storage. We literally just started an imaging lab. So this is just kind of a brief tour of what we got here. So I got to buy a lot of cool fancy toys. So flatbed scanner, just trust me, this is all like really cool high-end equipment. For a public library to have this space was really unique at the time. Usually, you know, 10 years ago, digitization was done with grants, with outsourcing, but to build this internal capacity was very important to us. So you may be wondering, okay, so why would you digitize everybody else's stuff? And the answer is, well, because we could, and more importantly, because we should. So this program came out of giving tours to other public librarians that would come through Take a look at all the fancy equipment that we were able to buy with the flood money and the John Adams money. And I started getting a sense that they weren't necessarily jealous, but they would ask me all the time, like, well, is there any way that we could, you know, we're feeling a lot of pressure to digitize our collections. And that's where we were 10 years ago. Librarians were feeling a lot of pressure to get their collections online, yet this was a very new skill, and they didn't know how to do it on their own. You know, not every library can, you know, pay to get all this equipment brought in and have the expertise to operate it. So I started, you know, we started thinking, like, maybe this is a service that we should scale out. If any of you come to visit the Boston Public, I think, are we doing a tour? No, we're not doing a tour. That's a different conference. Sorry. So this is the virtual tour. It's kind of hard to see, you know, black cameras on black walls, but this is what our imaging lab looks like. We were able to digitize artwork. We make sure that everything is, you know, visually accurate. We have all this fun, fancy equipment. This is, the funny part about the equipment that we originally bought, it didn't really work well for books for certain physical reasons. So in 2007, we partnered with the Internet Archive. So they run archive.org. Some of you might be familiar with the Wayback Machine. They do web archiving and stuff like that. In 2007, we started partnering with them because that was also when the Google book deal was happening. And Google approached us to be part of their second wave of book digitization. And it was a really interesting discussion we had back then, because on one hand, we have this huge corporation with lots of money that's offering to digitize all of our books, and that was very attractive. On the other hand, when we started thinking about it, to have a large corporate entity digitize our books really meant that, and this again, this is going back to this, the free-to-all spirit, it would have been a large corporate entity owning the digital files. And to be fair, you know, we have nothing against Google. They were going to be very generous with the digital files they were creating, but the thought that a commercial entity, we would have to go to them for permission to do certain things with these books was really unattractive to us. So we partnered with the Internet Archive. They brought in all of this equipment. It's called Scribes. We actually pay for this. We pay 10 cents per page to get these books digitized, but there are actual human beings sitting there. To be fair, it's a much smaller scale. Instead of 7 million books digitized, we have about 50,000, but we own those. And when I say we, I mean you. You can do whatever you want with these books. You can go online, you can download them, you can read them, you can download the entire, actually you can physically have the entire John Adams library if you want, because it's all online. We don't put any licensing restrictions on anything we do. And you can actually call us up and request books to be digitized. So this is just a little close-up view of how the books are digitized, and if any of you ever want to come to the BPL, I'd be happy to give you a tour of the imaging facilities. So it's just a little V-shaped cradle. You put the book in there. It's non-destructive. A lot of people freak out when they say that we're digitizing rare books, but this is no more physically rigorous on the books than it's like you're reading the book, but it's getting imaged at the same time. So there's two digital cameras up on the left-hand and the right-hand side. An Internet Archive operator can get through a 300-page book in about an hour, and then it shows up online. It's wonderful. So we're digitizing all this stuff. Does anybody know what this is from? This is a classic literature, but I think it's classic literature. Yes, the missing piece. So this was the big problem. So we're digitizing and digitizing. We don't have a metadata librarian. It's really just me and a bunch of cameras. The missing piece was the repository system, and this is kind of what we're here to talk about today. Where are we gonna put all this stuff? It was really hard to justify our existence in digitizing because we're really just, in many ways, we were just hiding stuff. We scanned stuff, it went onto a local hard drive, and then what? And that's really hard. You know, people were walking by, seeing all this expensive equipment going off, wondering, you know, what the heck these people are doing in there, because it wasn't accessible. You know, it wasn't really preserved. It was just sitting on a hard drive in much the same way that you guys probably keep your files at home. So what did we do? Knowing that we needed to create a repository, a preservation quality repository on our own was a very tough sell to internal stakeholders at the Boston Public Library. It's not something, at least in the public library world, that we were really well equipped to staff or fund. We didn't even understand it. We knew that we wanted to use open source technology. A lot of the subscription repositories out there we thought were too expensive and didn't work really well. But to convince administration, that meant hiring developers. And to convince a public library administration that we needed to hire basically a bunch of computer geeks was a totally foreign concept. So while we were arguing that, we engaged in this strategy, which I like to call the creation of promiscuous content. We basically put our stuff wherever we could. We opened up a Flickr account, and this account is still there to this day. This is not a preservation repository. It's an access system. So you guys are all familiar with Flickr. It's a social media platform for photo sharing. It costs $25 a year for a professional account. We just started uploading stuff to our Flickr account. And we started seeing, and this is where we started building the argument that the digitization that we're engaged in was valuable. And we kind of played dirty a little bit, because the most important thing about Flickr was that we were able to generate numbers from there. We were able to pull down statistics. So I started, we started building this argument where every month we would look at how many hits we got on our Flickr site, and we compare it to the number of people that showed up in our print department, which probably isn't fair, but it worked. So, you could tell on Flickr that, our collection was accessed or viewed 2 million times over the course of, a month and a half. And then our print department had like 3 guests that month. So we kept making this argument that this was really the direction we needed to go in. Again, getting back to the internet, so in the Internet Archive, Internet Archive is not just a digitization vendor. They run their own website, archive.org. They basically give you your own page, and again, you're able to go into the Internet Archive, take a look at all of the books that are there, see how many times they were downloaded, and start making the argument that this is, it's really shifting our success metrics. It was convincing administration that our currency is access and not actual currency. So circulation numbers have always been the number one success metric of libraries, and we just kind of glommed onto that. And we started including this in our circulation numbers. So that really kind of built the momentum to at least philosophically get administration to agree that yes, we did have to start hiring developers to do this internally. It's great that we have stuff on Flickr and Internet Archive, but we really wanted to take our own stewardship of this. This is an example of an Internet Archive page. This is our most, just another side point. This is our most popular book, and we have no idea why. History of the Yorubas. We look at statistics every month. This speaks to the selection of digitization. What really, for me, selection is really interesting because, we all think we know our collections well and we think we know what our users want. We totally don't. I have no idea why this is our most popular book. We digitized the entire John Adams library thinking that the books that had all of the written marginalia on it would be the most popular, and it's not. So selection for us has kind of become circular. We really look to our users to see what they want, and those are the things that we're digitizing. If you look carefully at the bottom right hand of this slide, you'll see download options. So this is the most important part about the Internet Archive. This isn't, if you go onto Google and find a book, you can read it, maybe. If it's in the public domain, you might be able to read it. With the Internet Archive, and this is something that we're going to emulate in our own system eventually, not only can you download the book as a PDF and read it on your own device, you can download all of the image files, you can download the optical character recognition with its character coordinate mapping, so it's just structured metadata that helps you display the book. So if you're a developer, you can basically recreate this entire system on your own. So there is nothing left to the imagination. You have all of the building blocks of building your own digital library system if you wanted to. You can download the image files, print out the books. We really believe strongly that we're not just in business to support research. We're fine with commerce also. If people want to download these books, print them out and sell them, they're in the public domain, you have every right to do that. So the way that we strategize to build momentum and funding for scaling up to a statewide level and actually hire repository developers is something I need to explain about the Boston Public Library. We are what used to be referred to as the Library of Last Recourse, which sounded incredibly tragic. Like, all the libraries are collapsing, run to the BPL. We've rebranded that as Library for the Commonwealth. So basically what that means is we are fortunate enough to have a state budget line. We basically act as the state library in Massachusetts. We are tasked with providing statewide service. It's up to us to decide what that statewide service, what form it takes. Traditionally, it's been statewide reference, which I would argue is less and less relevant these days because of Google. We use statewide money to buy databases that are probably more general use databases. So institutions like BU don't have to subscribe to the Boston Globe online, because if you live, work, or study in Massachusetts, you can get a Boston Public Library card, you can have access to those databases, and it frees up the academic institutions to spend their money on more specialized databases. So if you guys didn't know that, you should take advantage of that. And don't subscribe to that. You can just get a BPL card and tell your students to do the same. So we wrote an LSTA grant, Library Services and Technologies Act, for the acronym phobic out there, that funded a feasibility and usability study to, we really wanted to explore if offering our imaging labs and our repository, which didn't exist yet, to the entire state would make sense. And we spent 2 years, we put together this application. It's very simple. A lot of institutions that we work with, when they first come to us, they can't believe how easy it is. Essentially, you get this doesn't cost any money. It's already funded by the state. We decided to use our Library for the Commonwealth funding line to support this. And the benefit of that is, it turns out when you give people things for free, they go to their legislators and ask for the funding line to be increased. So never in the history of the Boston Public Library has somebody from North Adams advocated for us to have more money, but that's what's been happening, because we're providing a what I think is a pretty good service, and there's some of you out here who have used this service. You don't have to build your own repository system. You can just put it into Digital Commonwealth, and if you do that, you've basically given yourself a presence in the Digital Public Library of America as well. So this is the Digital Commonwealth portal. I was just out in North Adams, as a matter of fact. And I actually went to the Hoosac Tunnel, which is, I don't know if you guys know about the Hoosac Tunnel. It's really creepy. I guess at one point it was the longest tunnel in North America. So again, this is an example of a very, local story that now has a presence alongside Harvard, the Boston Public Library. It's a small little collection. That's just one photograph from it of the Hoosac Tunnel. I guess it was the first industrial use of dynamite for building tunnels or something like that. And it's haunted, and it's a creepy little story. And this collection was just sitting in a very stuffy room at the North Adams Public Library. And we drove out there one day. We're very friendly. We use zip cars. We're very low barrier. We're very personable. We don't just send shipping people out to pick up your stuff. We make sure you get to speak with us and trust us. So drove out to North Adams, brought this collection back to the Boston Public Library, had it imaged, and put it up onto Digital Commonwealth. And like I said, we're currently indexing between Digital Commonwealth and the Internet Archive. We're working with 350 different partners across the state, representing, I think, about two-thirds of the municipalities. So Massachusetts is, I would say, in terms of all the Digital Public Library of America partners, I think we've got the most coverage. So I'm very proud to say that. So, and if you didn't believe me, this is a map of all of our different partners that we're digitizing for. That's the big blank spot is the Quabbin watershed. I don't think there's actually people there, so that's why they're not just resting. There's nobody there. So here's an example of how this works. The Griffin Museum is a very small photography museum they're up in Winchester. They have no staff. They have no paid staff. They have one paid staff, actually, and I think she left. But they had a curator on staff, and her job was to basically put together shows. Arthur Griffin was a Boston Globe photographer in the first half of the 20th century, and has an amazing archive documenting life in Massachusetts and across New England in the first half of the 20th century. It's just sitting in folders, in filing cabinets in this museum. There's no librarian, there's no archivist. Thankfully, he was smart enough to arrange his photographs into subject folders. So we showed up there, and for free, we loaded the stuff into our car, brought it to the Boston Public Library. We have what's called a metadata mob. So even if you can't do descriptive information for your collection, we have a team that will do that for you. And that takes a bunch of different forms. With this particular collection, it was transcribing descriptions off of the folders, flipping the photos over, and transcribing all the descriptive information that was there. So now this collection is in Digital Commonwealth. They don't have their own website. They will never have their own website. They will never have a librarian. They will never have a flatbed scanner. They will never have digital cameras. And this has become one of our most popular collections. So the metadata is really what drives it. They're beautiful photos, but you know, you can type in cranberries. You can see all the cranberry farmers. You may notice on the left-hand side all of these different facets. So it's very searchable. It's very browsable. If you only want cranberry farmers from Cape Cod, you can filter your results down this way. So this is part of the value that we're putting into this. This is why this is better than Flickr. This is why this is better than just sticking stuff on a website. Everything we do, we have really excellent metadata librarians. We make sure that all of the metadata that we put in most of the metadata that we put in is authorized, meaning we're using Library of Congress subject headings that are linked to permanent URLs. So if other institutions upload photographs of cranberries, everything will be co-located if you want to do a subject search. Most people would never know to go to the Griffin Museum to research to get pictures of cranberry farmers. This is a close-up of the cranberry farmer. And again, this is the metadata that we provide. So what happens next is, you know, so we have this very local system. Even though it's statewide, you know, there's 50 states, it's still very local. Because we're a service hub of the Digital Public Library of America, every few months, they go into the Digital Commonwealth system and they harvest our metadata. They don't bring the actual assets over. We're actually hosting the digital files. They basically, we came up with a mapping file that said, here's our metadata profile, and here's how it fits into the Digital Public Library of America metadata profile. So now we are up another level, federated with all of the other institutions that are contributing to the Digital Public Library of America. So now it's discoverable at an even higher level. And this is really the important part. We're breaking down our buildings and business hours. Our users are beginning their information exploration online. Whether we like it or not, they're starting with Google. So we need to meet our users where they're at. We can't expect them to come into our buildings to know that we have these collections anymore. We can't expect them to know that if you go to the Boston Public Library website that they're going to find anything in particular. We just need to make sure that we are federating our collections, federating our metadata, and making sure it's discoverable at a very high level. So this is the same exact image that I showed you in Digital Commonwealth, and this is what it looks like in DPLA. DPLA has an API, application programming interface, which means, so we're adding, as our collections scale up into different systems, there's more and more value getting added to them. So you can click a button on DPLA and download all of the metadata. And that's become more and more important in this digital humanities world, in this computational world. You can start analyzing collections at a broad scale. And these aren't just individual items anymore. These are pieces of larger data sets. And I can't even imagine some of the research that's being made possible by that. It's pretty exciting. This is my braggy slide. So Digital Commonwealth, this is the number of things being indexed in DPLA. So we're right in the middle. We're the top middle there. So we're almost, actually that number is a little bit low. HathiTrust is the top contributor to DPLA, and I guess Dan Cohen was here yesterday and he probably talked about this. You'll notice that Harvard isn't on this list. It actually is really far down. We had the advantage of building our own system as DPLA was getting built. So everything that we coded on our own with our own developers using open source technology was meant to be free and open and harvestable. Harvard being Harvard, and I don't mean to pick on Harvard, but Harvard, 77 different libraries, everybody was an early adopter. They all have had digital systems for a very long time, but none of them are compatible with each other. The idea that you'd build a digital library in a different way than you're building your buildings was foreign back then. The idea was you're building your own repository for your own students, for your own environment, and
most of Harvard's digital assets are locked up in these very closed systems. So we're actually starting to crack Harvard a little bit, and a lot of their libraries are starting to come to us because they know that if it gets into digital commonwealth, it will very easily and subsequently be indexed by DPLA. Yes, sir?
What do those numbers measure?
Those are just a number of items that are being contributed. Yeah, so it's a pretty simple metric. So it's, again, as you go up, we're adding value. And one of the most valuable things about contributing to DPLA is now we've put our assets in an environment that's very open to developers. DPLA is more than just a big index digital library. They invite developers to download data sets and build apps on top of our collections. So these are just a few examples of little apps you can download. Some of them are goofy. Some of them are more serious research tools. You know, historical GIFs. I think there's something called like cat generator or something like that, where every week, no, it's a little Twitter bot, and it pulls images of cats out of DPLA and it tweets them. So if you're interested in historical cat images, you can use that app. Another thing that's very important about how we're digitizing, this idea of crowdsourcing. This is a ship log from a whaling ship log from the New Bedford Whaling Museum. Nobody's going to go through and read this, I don't think. I mean, maybe you will. But this is a daily account of the weather and whether or not they caught a whale. Embedded in these whaling logs are very important historical climate data that is helping us understand climate change. We didn't have sensors bobbing around in the South Pacific and North Atlantic back in the mid-1800s. So now that these have been digitized, they can be put into platforms. I don't know if any of you are familiar with the Citizen Science Zooniverse tools, but these can now be transcribed. These are now available for transcription for the general public, and this is contributing to this climate data set, which otherwise was locked up in handwritten historical documents. I know I'm short on time, so I just want to quickly go through a few of my favorite things. Talked about cats, cat on a toilet. This is from the Leslie Jones collection. These are historical photographs we have at the BPL. We have men in sewer. We have cats on toilets, men in sewers. We have a pee. So, peas are good for you. This is actually, we work with the Clark Art Institute, which is out in Williamstown. So we're not just digitizing boring historical photos and stuff. We were actually doing artwork and stuff like that. This is one of my very favorite collections. This is from the Natick Soldier and Sailor Institute, which is, there's an army base out in Natick, and they've been prototyping all of the, basically the way they describe it is all the stuff that the military uses that doesn't kill people. So all of the food rations, they've developed camouflage. This is the Christmas dinner that the Apollo astronauts ate. So they have this huge archive of all, and it's, you know, horrible color and very kitschy, but it's a pretty interesting collection. One of the things that we noticed as we're going through this collection, all of the photos of male soldiers, they look very stern and angry. All of the female soldiers are always smiling. So this, when you start looking at a collection in its entirety, you start seeing patterns. We actually asked them about that, and it was really interesting. Back when these photos were taken, there weren't women in the military to the extent there is now. So the males are actual soldiers. The females are actually just models. So that's why the women are smiling and the men are not. We've digitized Helen Keller's bathing suit. This is out at the Fisk Public Library in Wrentham. And just my final slide, just to show you other types of things we digitize. The Tufts Library in Weymouth has this amazing collection of butterflies that we brought in. This we actually had to hire a shipping company for. What's awesome about this collection is not just the butterflies themselves, but the amount of metadata that came with it. Every one of these butterflies has the Linnaean taxonomic name embedded in the metadata, and we ran that through the Library of Congress authority file. So these are actually, the metadata we have for this is authorized down to the genus level. So again, it's all searchable and findable, free to all, digital commonwealth. So thank you.